This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week, but we're happy to share our special coverage of the House January 6 Committee's critical public hearings. Today's episode, Day 5, originally recorded on June 23rd.
In our previous hearings, the Select Committee showed that then-President Trump applied pressure at every level of government, from local election workers up to his own vice president, hoping public servants would give in to that pressure and help him steal an election he actually lost.
What?
Did he say steal?
He said steal.
He stole the election that he actually lost. Thank you, sir.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Finally.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Well, better now.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lancaster, Pennsylvania's WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, in Palenville, New York, on WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day. On the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and all your favorite podcast sites except for Spotify. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for special coverage day 5 of the January 6 hearings. And yes, that was January 6 committee chair Benny Thompson opening Thursday's fifth day of hearings by referring to Donald Trump's attempt to steal the 2020 election. It only took a year and a half, but
somebody finally said it.
Yeah, someone on the panel used the accurate words to explain what happened. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
If you follow this show, you know that we have been very critical about the Democrats and the bulk of the corporate media's failure to describe it as such, using all sorts of words like undermine the results, reverse the election, attempts to undo it. As Washington Post wrote just yesterday, undo the election. Donald Trump, the president of the United States, tried to steal a presidential election. Many times and in many ways. It was nothing short of that. And if a Democrat had done it, you can bet your bottom dollar that Republicans would have been describing it as such every day, every minute since then. So hopefully, media pick up on that simple bumper sticker language to explain exactly what went on here, because I think it will help a lot. I will be joined momentarily by two excellent guests for special coverage insight and analysis of Thursday's Day 5 hearings, which just now wrapped up moments ago. But very quickly, some news from the Supreme Court that I need to at least wave at today. In a major expansion of gun rights and a major blow to the states' rights that Republicans claim to believe in when it's a right to create laws and restrictions that they actually care about, the Supreme Court said on Thursday that all Americans have a right to carry firearms in public, even when elected officials accountable to the electorate in states and local jurisdictions had determined otherwise. The unelected, rogue, corrupt, stolen, and packed U.S. Supreme Court majority in a 6-3 decision comes on the heels of a series of recent mass shootings and is expected to ultimately allow more people to legally carry guns on the streets of the nation's largest cities, including New York, L.A., Boston, and elsewhere, despite the large majorities of Americans who oppose the expansion of unregulated weaponry on our streets, completely ignoring the, quote, well-regulated part of the Second Amendment's right for members of a state militia to bear arms. The Republican justices struck down a 100-year-old New York law requiring that licensed applicants show proper cause to carry a concealed weapon outside of their homes. Writing for the majority, the court's most corrupt justice, and that's a close call at this point, Clarence Thomas wrote, quote, New York's proper cause requirement violates the 14th Amendment by preventing law-abiding citizens with ordinary self-defense needs from exercising their Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms in public for self-defense. The majority, who claim to be strict constitutionalists who interpret the text of the Constitution literally, apparently have a version of the Constitution where the part about states having the right to, quote, well regulate their militias has been whited out. Perhaps because, you know, you can't murder an entire subway car full of people in New York City with free speech. Nonetheless, Chief Justice Roberts, during the oral arguments for this, said that the Second Amendment right to carry arms in public is really no different than the First Amendment right to, you know, find a street corner to express your free speech. Jeez. Yeah, really. So that's where we are. We'll have more on that, no doubt, in the days ahead. But the Supreme Court does not answer to the electorate. The court's decision is wildly out of step with public opinion. Among voters in the 2020 presidential election, according to AP's expansive vote cast survey of the electorate, just 1 in 10 Americans, that's 10%, felt that gun laws should be less strict than they currently are. But again, the Supreme Court, they don't answer to the electorate. Who they answer to? Well, I'll leave that to you for today, as I suspect we'll discuss this more in the days ahead. Also receiving less attention on Thursday, thanks to the decision to expand guns in the U.S. and everything else going on today, the Supreme Court also just gutted Miranda rights. Yep. Ruling that a person who did not receive their Miranda warning when detained by law enforcement officials, that he or she has the right, for example, to remain silent, has the right to an attorney. Apparently, such a person has no right to sue the government for the constitutional violation. So it was there, once again, another 6-3 ruling by the rogue, corrupt, stolen, and packed U.S. Supreme Court. But again, more in the days ahead. For the moment, we need to focus today, once again, on the previous president's many failed attempts to steal the 2020 election by overthrowing the U.S. government itself. To that end, of all of Trump's many schemes to steal a second term in office from the American people, the one that has always frightened me the most, frankly, was his plan, which came within a hair's breadth of actually succeeding, to decapitate the U.S. Department of Justice and install an apparatchik as Attorney General on January 3rd, 2021, who had never even tried a criminal trial before. A man who would do his bidding by sending a letter to swing states falsely informing them that the DOJ had found massive fraud in the 2020 election, that the department no longer had confidence in the results, and that the state legislatures should reconvene in special sessions in Georgia, Arizona, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere to select electors for Trump rather than the voters who had actually elected. That apparatchik was a lowish level attorney at DOJ, a guy by the name of Jeffrey Clark, who had agreed to do Trump's bidding and to lie about the DOJ's finding that there was no fraud that would have affected the results of the election. Clark was told by Trump that he would name him as acting attorney general in place of then acting attorney general Jeff Rosen, who had replaced Bill Barr, who had resigned over all of this just days before. And that almost actually happened, but for a dramatic hours-long late night celebrity apprentice style boardroom meeting in the Oval Office with Clark and Rosen facing off in front of Trump, along with Rosen's acting deputy attorney general, Richard Donahue, and Trump's own White House counsel declaring that they would all resign en masse, along with the entire top level of the Justice Department prosecutors, if Trump pulled that trigger. It was that dramatic standoff that likely prevented a full-on American coup against the United States government carried out by the President of the United States, which prevented the overthrow of this nation as we know it. And that dramatic moment was at the center of Thursday's fifth day of hearings by the bipartisan U.S. House Select Committee investigating the January 6 insurrection and Trump's multiple attempts to steal the 2020 election. As I said, it just wrapped up moments ago. It included live testimony from former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen, his acting Deputy AG Richard Donahue, and former Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Office of Legal Counsel, or the OLC, Steve Engel. And it specifically focused on Trump's pressure campaign on the DOJ in his hopes of what committee chair Benny Thompson actually out loud described as Donald Trump's attempt to steal the election. At one point, when describing the dramatic January 3rd Oval Office meeting and what would happen if, in fact, acting Attorney General Rosen was fired and replaced with Jeff Clark, who had never even tried a criminal case, Donahue explained what they told the president when he asked, well, what did he have to lose if he did it anyway?
And the president said, what do I have to lose? And it was actually a good opening because I said, Mr. President, you have a great deal to lose. And I began to explain to him what he had to lose and what the country had to lose and what the department had to lose. And this was not in anyone's best interest. That conversation went on for some time. Everyone essentially chimed in with their own thoughts, all of which were consistent about how damaging this would be to the country, to the department, to the administration, to him personally. And then I said, and we're not the only ones. No one cares if we resign. If Steve and I go, that's fine. It doesn't matter. But I'm telling you what's going to happen. You're going to lose your entire department leadership. Every single AAG will walk out on you. Your entire department leadership will walk out within hours. And I said, Mr. President, within 24, 48, 72 hours, you could have hundreds and hundreds of resignations of the leadership of your entire Justice Department because of your actions. What's that going to say about you?
And that appears to have finally stopped at least that part of Donald Trump's coup attempt. After days and days of haranguing the Department of Justice with one conspiracy theory after another, I should add one debunked conspiracy theory after another about fraud. Nonetheless, Donald Trump, after being told time and time again by everyone at the DOJ, at the Department of Homeland Security, and the Department of the Defense Department that none of these claims were true, he still went out and repeated them on the ellipse during his January 6th speech, his rally just before the attack on the U.S. Capitol. Near the end of Thursday's fifth day of hearings, the committee shared video evidence that at least six members of Congress, by my count, had sought pardons from Donald Trump for their parts in all of this, including Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, Louie Gohmert of Texas, Andy Biggs of Arizona, and if I understood it, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia. The witnesses testified today shortly after CNN broke the news just before the hearings began that federal investigators conducted a search on Wednesday morning of the home of Jeffrey Clark, the former DOJ lawyer who Trump sought to install as AG in the days before the January 6 riot. Later reporting in the day said it was a pre-dawn raid that resulted in Jeffrey Clark on the street in his pajamas. No additional information is yet available as to what the FBI may have been seeking in Clark's home, if in fact that is what they were doing there. So yeah, lots of drama, even before Thursday's exceedingly dramatic hearing got underway. Joining us for insight and smart analysis of all of this today, Well, two guests, one of whom knows quite a bit about the inner workings of government, particularly at the Department of Justice. Lisa Graves is now the executive director of TrueNorthResearch.org. She's board president of the Center for Media and Democracy. And she also happens to be a former department, a former deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Justice Department herself. She's also a former chief counsel for nominations in the U.S. Senate and a former deputy chief for the U.S. court system and a longtime friend of the broadcast. Welcome back, Lisa Graves. Great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Brad. I am a longtime fan and friend of the broadcast. Thanks for having me.
You're very kind. Also, as always, during our J6 hearings special coverage, we're joined once again by Heather Digby Parton, known as simply Digby to her fans at her long-running Hullabaloo blog and as an award-winning opinion and analysis journalist at Salon.com. And I think this would be, well, of course, Heather's fifth appearance on the show to cover the hearings to date. One more such appearance, and she will earn a free sub sandwich. Welcome back to the show, Heather.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so exhausted and hungry. So,
I know.
Here we are.
There you go. As the hearings just finished, as I said, literally about 20 minutes or so before going on air, we haven't been able to pull as many clips as we normally do. So I'm going to have to count on you two to help paint colorful pictures of the drama today. Heather, of all of the Trump plots to steal the 2020 election, this is the one that frankly terrified me the most. And it seems to have been the closest to have actually, almost been pulled off. And there have been some comparisons to Richard Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, as he kept firing AGs until he found one, Robert Bork, that was willing to fire the special counsel overseeing the Watergate investigation. But from what we've learned about Trump's plot, had it been successful, it seems to me that it would have made that one, the Saturday Night Massacre, pale by comparison. Am I right about that?
Well, I think so. I mean, the Saturday Night Massacre was an abomination, as we know, and it certainly did shift the entire sort of political environment that was unfolding during the Watergate scandal. But this would have been completely different. I mean, we were, just three weeks away, I think, at the time of the inauguration, and there was this dispute, this trumped-up dispute over the election.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine that would literally have been the constitutional crisis that everybody was kind of hinting at mm-hmm. the time, which we now look back in retrospect and realize was a very close thing. I mean,
this,
when you say overthrow the government, sometimes that's a little confusing because Trump was the president at the time,
right.
So was he overthrowing the government, his own government?
Which is why steal election. That, everyone could understand that he tried to steal the election. But yeah, he was trying to overthrow the government.
Yeah, I mean, literally so. In this sense, what he was trying to do was to basically put the Department of Justice at his service, and all these people leaving, which is very interesting to me that he actually backed off on that. It may be one of the few rational decisions he made during that period. And frankly, I'm a little surprised they were able to reason with him at that moment enough to get him to see what kind of a risk he would be taking,
mm-hmm.
because he was already so far out, completely out to lunch on everything.
Yep.
that I'm surprised that he was able to see just, how serious it would be if the entire upper level and God knows how many U.S. attorneys decided to leave. And, what it does say, though, right, is that Trump was not irrational. He did know
exactly
what he was doing. So,
yes.
A new interesting data point that comes out of that.
Excellent. Excellent point. Lisa Graves, as a former DOJ official with one of those really long titles, Deputy Assistant Attorney General, I think you served during both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Am I right?
I did. I participated in the orderly transition of government. Are you there?
Yes.
Sorry. Between the transition from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration and had the opportunity, so to speak, to advise Attorney General John Ashcroft
mm-hmm.
Before I left to go become the deputy chief for the U.S. court system for the Article III judges. So that's a tale for drinks, perhaps, one of these days. But Now is no time to celebrate, given the seriousness of what we saw unfold today.
Well, what I'm curious about is during all your years at Justice, and I know there was quite a bit of dysfunction. Certainly at W's DOJ. I mean, did you ever witness anything remotely like this kind of jockeying for position? Much less for the top gig as Attorney General, among the a rank and file deputy or assistant AG at the Justice Department. In other words, how unusual was something like what Jeffrey Clark was trying to pull off?
Well, I have to say that Ms. Reno was a very thoughtful leader of the department, and there were no such machinations. When Ashcroft came in, it was sort of, there was a delay for his confirmation, so there was a lot of jockeying, and one of the people jockeying for position was Ted Cruz.
Mm.
So I had the, I don't know if it's displeasure, having to work with him on some occasions, and one of the things that happened when I would have to bring briefing books down to his office was that he had this little paperweight that sparkled in the sun, and I didn't really ever want to go too far into his office before, for fear of getting trapped by his questions about who I could trust, who he could trust. That was the question. But one day he was on the phone, and so I sidled over to this paperweight, and I looked down, and the thing that was sparkling in the sun, they were Chads. And the paperweight said, Bush-Cheney Florida Recount Team 2000.
Oh.
And so I thought I would share that with you, Brad. I thought, and you as well, Digby,
yep.
Heather. I thought that might be of interest. But I'll say that the tale, the story that was told today about this sort of not just forum shopping, but basically AG shopping, by the president and his the worst advisors possible, plucking out Jeffrey Clark, who actually was notorious for his role in trying to attack the EPA's endangerment finding before he was tasked with leading the Environment and Natural Resources Division within the Justice Department, or having a senior role within the Justice Department. This is a man who was willing to bend, it seems, any law in order to serve the political agenda of this president, and is exactly the type of person who should never be entrusted with any position of power or public trust. Even though he'd been in a number of Republican administrations, he clearly is someone who was more than willing to set aside facts and law as the acting attorney general and the deputy attorney general and the head of the Trump head of the Office of Legal Counsel detailed during this hearing how Clark had no relevant experience to lead the United States Department of Justice, how he was willing to put forward letters that were crafted seemingly by John Eastman, the man who is also at the center of this series of what I believe to be crimes that have been described by the evidence that has been put forward by this committee, and even sought to enlist the acting attorney general and deputy attorney general in this scheme to direct these state legislatures to set aside the lawful votes of the American people and to substitute an alternate fake slate of electors in order to provide a basis, an illegitimate basis, quite frankly, for Mike Pence to not allow the votes to be counted on January 6th. And so what we see is this man at the center of a criminal conspiracy, in my view, and the president is at the helm of that conspiracy. And I was certainly interested to see that today the Justice Department did execute a subpoena to seize presumably documents and devices from Mr. Clark. We'll see what remains of his devices and what may be retrievable from those devices. But I'm glad that there was action by the Justice Department to gather evidence, even though it is now 2022, to execute such a warrant to seize materials that he may have.
And he did. And actually, I have some follow-ups on the way the DOJ works. But are you able to tell? I know they raided his home. I think it was a pre-dawn raid on Wednesday. It's unclear to me what laws would have actually been broken. And Lisa Graves, you referenced a criminal conspiracy. But What laws would have been broken in the case where Donald Trump fires his acting AG? He's got the right to fire him and had then, you know, replaced him with Jeffrey Clark, who moved ahead with this scheme. What would actually be unlawful about that?
Well, I think that, as everyone knows, the Attorney General can be replaced by a president, even though the Attorney General is confirmed by the United States Senate. But here you have an effort to install someone with a specific purpose to interfere in a lawful election, to, in essence, direct these states to set aside the lawful votes, to interfere in the electoral count that was slated to happen by our Constitution on January 6th of that year. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it was for his role in seeking the office of Attorney General, but I presume that the search warrant was executed, and I haven't read the terms of it yet, but I presume that it was in connection with this broader scheme, the scheme to set aside the election, to interfere with that lawful activity of our United States government.
Well,
how our democracy is supposed to function. Those are constitutional duties. They are legal duties, and they are important ones. And so I don't know. We'll see. I don't know. We don't know whether there is a grand jury sitting right now. We don't know what the array of crimes that have occurred may be charged. I think we've certainly seen evidence of crimes, and some of that is well before this hearing when you when we heard the audio of Donald Trump threatening the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, with potential criminal prosecution for failing to do the bidding of Donald Trump.
Well,
I think there's a myriad of crimes that may have been committed by these individuals, Donald Trump and the people who were aiding and abetting him.
I hope that you're right, Lisa, about that trying to get him for partaking in this scheme to stop the peaceful transfer of power. Because if you are right about that, if that is what the Department of Justice is looking for with Jeff Clark, well, there's a few guys who were above him, at least one guy who was above him, Donald Trump, who would have, obviously participated in that exact same thing. And if the DOJ is now rounding up folks who participated in that conspiracy, that's good news for Americans, bad news for the president, the disgraced former president of the United States. Heather, when they started this thing, these hearings, Liz Cheney, I think, said that they plan, when they announced the committee, that Liz Cheney, I think it was, said that they plan to review every minute, every phone call, every email, every text message around what happened on January 6th. I thought at the time, well, that was an exaggeration. They're not going to look at every minute, every text message, but it wasn't. That's actually what they've done, it seems to me. A plus for the committee, in my opinion. As someone who's been following all this stuff very closely, nonetheless, what did you glean from Thursday's hearings that you did not know or fully understand before day five?
Well, I'm one of those nerds who's read all these books, right, by the journalists and various people from the big newspapers about this post-election period and subsequent to that. So I knew a lot of this stuff, and we've seen a lot of it reported in the newspapers as well, but there's just nothing like having the actual people who were there relay this information and tell us, in their own voices exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think this one was intensely valuable for that, because these guys, and this is the thing, I keep saying this, but it's so important for people to realize this. There's going to be a huge pushback. There already is one on the part of the Republicans saying, this is a partisan hearing and there's nobody there to support the president's side and blah, blah, blah. Well, these were Trump people. Jeff Rosen and Stephen Engel in particular, but they were Trumpers.
Yeah.
These are people, and they wouldn't have been there in December of 2020 if they were not real Trump people, right?
That's
right. Anybody with any sense, anybody who understood what they were dealing with had left long ago. Even Bill Barr, jump ship.
Exactly.
So, I mean, these people, they were the real deal. And they were definitely Trump people. Just like Rusty Bowers, the guy who from Arizona, who mm-hmm. testified the other day. I mean, all of these people who were testifying in at great length and in great detail and very vividly telling the story of what happened are Trump people. They're not defending him because he is indefensible. And the idea that somehow or another this is partisan is ridiculous. It would be partisan if they had, I don't know, AOC up there testifying all day, right? Or it was just some kind of nonstop, you know, rah-rah for Joe Biden or something. But, I mean, that is not what's happening here. These are Republicans. So, to that extent, when you watch these things and you watch these guys who I truly believe, especially Engel, who was involved in some pretty dicey stuff for Trump over mm-hmm. he's from the
OLC.
Legal counsel,
yeah.
And he's not somebody I would have ever, you know, thought had a lot of integrity, let me just put it that way. But even for people
even
like
him,
this was too much.
Yeah.
This is it went too far, and I think that really that speaks volumes about the committee and how and the story that they're telling.
And it should be noted that it was Adam Kinzinger, Republican from
right.
Illinois, who led the questioning on Thursday of the three DOJ officials. I got to get to a quick break here. So very quickly, Lisa Graves, you know, the testimony that this low-level guy, Jeff Clark, was asked to meet directly with the president in the Oval Office, apparently did several times. And didn't tell the attorney general. Apparently that was in violation of DOJ policy or guidelines. What would you have done when you were at the DOJ as an assistant deputy attorney general had you been invited to meet the president at the White House in the Oval Office? What would have been the process for something like that?
Well, I was Deputy Assistant Attorney General, and before that I was Senior Counsel and Counsel, and the rules were quite clear in the department that no one was permitted to go to the White House to meet with the President or other officials unless those visits were approved. The same rule actually also applied with respect to Congress. There are offices at the department, the Office of Legislative Affairs, which handles those direct communications with Congress, and they are the conduits for those communications, other than, you know, the Attorney General himself or herself. And similarly, when I was invited to go to the White House for meetings, those were always meetings that were approved as part of, you know, our official delegation to the White House from the Justice Department on official matters. And so it's highly irregular and unacceptable for other attorneys to be meeting with the White House for the very reasons that Mr. Rosen and the others described, which is that you cannot have attorneys and other staff of the department basically being pressured by a president or his or her staff to do the bidding, the political agenda of the president. The Department of Justice is supposed to be separate from those political machinations, and the presidents are not supposed to be involved in criminal prosecutions or other matters, decisions by the Justice Department. And so it's extraordinarily irregular. And I just wanted to say one of the joys of my working at Maine Justice was coming in through the beautiful aluminum doors on Pennsylvania Avenue, which are where there's engraved at the top that the place of justice is a hallowed place. And it's hallowed by the acts of civil servants to serve the people of this country without a political agenda, partisan agenda, but to serve all of the American people and not to serve one president and his political electoral agenda. And so to have someone like Clark in a role at the department that he's clearly unfit for, I hope he's never allowed to be appointed to anything ever again. He is unworthy of public trust.
Maybe dishwasher in prison. And by the way, how big of a deal would it have been when you were at DOJ if all of the assistant AGs at once had said that they would resign if something happened?
It would be an enormously big deal. And I think that's the one, real threat in some ways that those officials hold is the ability to resign together
mm-hmm.
Against a request to engage in illegal conduct. So that is the appropriate course of action, along with telling the public what's happening at the time, unlike Bill Barr, who did not tell the public what was happening at the time and only spoke, I think, truthfully when he was under oath about what was happening. His public statements were very, obsequious toward toward Donald Trump, despite what he knew was happening behind the scenes. And, you know, I'm appreciative of the testimony of the gentleman today, and I also wish that they had spoken out directly at the time to describe the scheme, the illegal schemes that Mr. Clark was attempting to engage in on behalf of President Trump, which they themselves told him personally he was engaging in during those meetings that were described in detail today for Congress and for the American people.
That is Lisa Graves, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice. She is my guest, along with Heather Digby Parton of Salon and Hullabaloo. I got to take a quick break. We're back with more special coverage of Day 5 of the January 6 hearings with both of them and Desi Doyen. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at the Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
The issue really wasn't about me. The issue was the use of the Justice Department. And it's just so important that the Justice Department adhere to the facts and the law. That's what it's there to do. And that's what our constitutional role was. And so if the Justice Department gets out of the role that it's supposed to play, that's really bad for our country. And when you damage our fundamental institutions, it's not easy to repair them.
Oh, man, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Special coverage of Day 5 of the January 6 hearings. That was former Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen talking about, you know, just what it was that Donald Trump was asking him to do that he was refusing to do, essentially refusing to lie about fraud in the 2020 election. Welcome back. We're here with Lisa Graves and Heather Digby Parton. Heather, Trump was told over and over again that these claims were false. We talked a little bit about this at the previous hearing. He was told by everyone that he spoke to. You know, we heard it with his phone call with Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. But now we hear it from, you know, top members of the DOJ who had to chase down every single nonsensical conspiracy theory that Donald Trump brought to him, dragged in from the internet. Now, I was chasing those down as well, but that's kind of my job. But it didn't matter to Trump that these claims were false. He did not care. And he even went and repeated them, you know, on January 6th at his rally at the Eclipse, at the Ellipse. But it seems like the fact that it was false is sort of beside the point. The claims were enough as he saw it. That was all he needed. He said, let me and the Republican congressman take care about it. How do we even make sense of that kind of thinking?
It's very difficult, especially when you get to the end there. You know, I mean, it was one thing back in the early part of December when they were kind of working up the various strands of the coup plotting that they were doing with Rudy out in the courts and, you know, running his game with Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis and all of that. I mean, they were trying to take these crazy cases to court and probably testing the thesis that, hey, we got all these Trump judges, maybe we can really make some of this work. None of that worked, right? I mean, that was kind of the end of it, which, you know, you can make a case that he had a right to do that. It was stupid and ridiculous and undemocratic and unethical, but okay, there is that avenue for someone to challenge elections. All those cases, none of them panned out, and at that point he refused to give up. He refused to admit that he had lost. So then we're dealing, I think, with a psychological problem, which I think we can all agree is what we're dealing with, Donald Trump.
Yes.
And, you know, he could not give it up. One of the most vivid moments in the hearing was, I think it was Donahue, who was an excellent witness, by the way. I thought he was really, really good. And he said that, you know, after this amazing meeting that they had, right, with all of them sitting there, he's there in his T-shirt and muddy boots, and they're having this big conversation, and they all threatened to quit, and it was the murder-suicide pact, et cetera, et cetera. There's this big moment. He goes back to the office, and just within an hour or so, Trump's calling him up and saying, hey, have you heard about this truckload of
shredded ballots,
shredded ballots down in Georgia? And it's like, that's insane, right? I mean, that is that suggests that there's something really wrong with him. So here we are again wondering, did he know that that he had lost? Did he not know? He was told. Could he? Is he incapable of understanding? And I keep coming back to the same thing. If he did know and he was just lying to save his ego, okay, then, you know, that's he is what he is, and
he's a psychopath or a sociopath
in service of that. But if he's crazy and really did not understand after all of this, couldn't comprehend what dozens and dozens of people around him, some of his closest aides, were telling him, then how in the world could that guy be president again? I mean, it's like we barely escaped that the man is completely, I mean, he's got, you know, obviously some kind of mental issues that should preclude him. And that brings me to something that Lisa said before the break, which was, you know, she said she wishes that they'd come forward at the time, and I think we all do. It's kind of, you know, why are we only hearing so much about this now, right? Why wasn't that said in the moment? And, you know, I guess I can understand on some level that people didn't know how far it was going to go, and it was before January 6th, so nobody knew there was going to be a riot and an insurrection. But, you know, when everybody did know what had happened, understood the full scope of and the consequence of what Trump had done, was after January 6th when they impeached Donald Trump. And if these people had all come forward then, during that impeachment, when there was still a moment when maybe they could have grabbed enough Republicans to do it, and I know it was a long shot, but you never know, if all of those people had come forward then they could have, at the very, you know, it wouldn't have meant anything to what had happened, but it would have precluded Donald Trump from running for office again. That was the reason for doing the impeachment, and they didn't do it. So, you know, as much as I'm glad that they're saying what they're saying, and let's hope it adds up to something, and, you know, history now at least will have a proper record. I find it hard to understand why, after what they knew, that they didn't come forward in that particular moment to at the very least spare us what we're about to experience, which is another Donald Trump campaign and potential Donald Trump administration, which is unthinkable.
And which wouldn't have happened had he been found guilty.
That's right.
And we should note, by the way, a majority of the Senate, a bipartisan majority of the Senate, did think he was guilty of inciting this riot. I hate when they say, oh, he was acquitted. Well, he was acquitted, except there was a 57-43 majority of senators felt he was guilty of inciting this insurrection of the U.S. government. Lisa, let me pick up on this point about, you know, just how insane Donald Trump is or isn't. I don't think he's insane, because there's a whole bunch of people just like him who hear about these claims about fraud and they are debunked, and yet they believe them over and over again. Now, all of these folks, these MAGA folks, including Jeff Clark, they all believed, it seems, this nonsense about fraud that was simply not true, no matter how many times that they were told. Now, before you were, well, actually, since working at the Department of Justice, you found a respectable line of work by investigating sort of these right-wing networks. You've spearheaded over many years a lot of breakthrough investigations into the distortion of American democracy and public policy by folks like the infamous Koch brothers and now the Koch network. Is this how they operate? Simply repeating each other's fraudulent nonsense to each other, no matter how many times it's been shown to be nonsense, and then build a political strategy on that? How should we understand this among the right that you have studied? And is there a similar mindset among those on the left?
Well, you know, I was going to say, Brad, that on the first point, I think, the beginning of that, you know, obviously, as you point out, a majority of senators found that there was ample evidence to impeach Donald Trump and bar him from future political office. And I agree with you. I think that he is not incompetent in the sense of not being able to be held responsible for his actions, you know, like criminally insane.
Mm-hmm.
He is someone who is malevolent. He, in my personal view, is someone who is like a magnet of corruption and people who are venal and who seek power at any cost, and he attracts them like iron, like a magnet attracts iron filing, surrounding himself with some of the most corrupt and venal people that we've ever seen in administration, and that's actually saying something,
yes.
Given you know, the history with Nixon and some of the others.
Yeah.
But the fact is that you know, I think that you can't really underestimate his determination to get power and remain in power, and I think his former counsel, who you know was convicted and served time, Mr. Cohen, described quite plainly to Congress over a year ago that if Trump, you know, were elected, that he would never leave office willingly. He was absolutely correct in that. He knows the man, and that's what we saw here was an attempt to use anything to stay in power, no matter how false, how disproven, how debunked. And you can see that in the statement that was emphasized by Congressman Kinzinger and by the witnesses, that in essence, Donald Trump said to the top officials of the Justice Department, just sign onto this and we'll take care of the rest. Doesn't matter that these officials have told him that these claims are baseless, that there aren't facts to support them, that the facts have been refuted, debunked, that they're groundless, that the legal theories are outlandish and outrageous and unsupported. He was willing to say anything, do anything to stay in power, and that's what the evidence shows, which shows that he's, you know, unfit for public office. And I do think, you know, to the question that you concluded with,
mm-hmm.
you know, how can people believe this? You know, first of all, it's not that it's just Trump, this malevolent figure who is sort of fixing himself as their savior, as the embodiment of their ability to express hate without shame. It's that Trump is someone who lies to them, but those lies are backed up every single night by Fox News personalities, and not news, but that's what, you know, the official name, but Fox personalities, who are continuing to perpetuate Trump's lies on, you know, basically on almost every issue. But the thing about it is that that's not the only lie they've told. Fox wasn't telling the American people that were watching Fox that the economy was doing so much better under Obama, that the stock market was going up and up and up. It only started emphasizing the stock market's growth mm-hmm. after Trump was elected.
Right.
So all those people who watch Fox weren't told that is the same trend line on the economy until COVID hit that was started under Obama. Now, I have criticisms of some of those economic policies because of the focus on Wall Street versus Main Street, and I know that that's been written about quite a bit on Hullabaloo, which I urge everyone to subscribe to as well. But, you know, the fact is that lying to their constituents, lying to their audience, is part and parcel what Fox personalities like Tucker Carlson do. They mislead them. They like redirect them, refocus them. Look over here. You know, they're not telling them about the unemployment rate right now. They're focusing on inflation, which is a real issue. But when they're talking about inflation, they're asserting that President Biden could do something about the price of gas. Meanwhile, these same pundits, you know, have talked about this free market sort of fundamentalism where the free market knows no wrong. And so those same politicians that Trump backs, that Trump is tied to, and that Fox backs, you know, are doing everything they can to stop there from being any regulation of these oil and gas companies, like a windfall profits tax and more. Instead, they want to somehow try to blame President Biden in order to, you know, try to gain in the election.
No.
So that's lie after lie after lie from Trump and his cohorts, and it's surround sound due to Fox and OAN and Bannon and others.
You're right. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And I got to get to a quick break here. But yeah, you make a great point. It's one thing when you have an accomplished liar like Donald Trump out there saying these lies over and over again. But it's another thing when you're hearing them echoed on in your media ecosystem, whether it's Fox News or, I must point out, all across the radio dial on the free public airwaves where all of this stuff is also repeated. Good luck hearing people tell the truth. As we try to do here on the broadcast, you are more likely to be groomed in your car on the way to and from work by all of these lies. Quick break, and we're back for our closing few thoughts, and we'll talk about these little news here of these requests for pardons by at least 5 or 6 members of Congress who apparently, I guess, thought they did something wrong that merited a pardon from Donald Trump. We'll take a quick break, come back with that with Heather Digby Parton and Lisa Graves. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
At some point, the conversation turned to whether Jeff Clark was even qualified, competent to run the Justice Department, which in my mind, he clearly was not. I thought it was useful to point out to the president that Jeff Clark simply didn't have the skills, the ability, and the experience to run the department. And so I said, Mr. President, you're talking about putting a man in that seat who has never tried a criminal case, who's never conducted a criminal investigation. He's telling you that he's going to take charge of the department, 115,000 employees, including the entire FBI, and turn the place on a dime and conduct nationwide criminal investigations that will produce results in a matter of days. It's impossible. It's absurd. It's not going to happen, and it's going to fail.
Oh, what does he care? Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. That was the second in command at the Department of Justice as Donald Trump was trying to use the DOJ to, yes, steal the 2020 election. Welcome back, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, and our special coverage of the fifth day of hearings in the dramatic hearings in the U.S. House Select Committee investigating January 6th. Lisa Graves, there was a testimony at the very end about the appeal for blanket pardons from Mo Brooks of Alabama, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Scott Perry of Pennsylvania, Louis Gohmert of Texas, Andy Biggs of Arizona. I think Jim Jordan of Ohio brought it up but didn't ask directly for one. And I think they said Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia also sought a pardon. What does that mean? Isn't involved in a pardon the recognition that the person being pardoned committed an actual crime, Lisa?
Well, it certainly is a sign of a guilty conscience, a fear that they have committed a crime, and I think it's extremely troubling. There was also discussion of Trump discussing pardoning family members and perhaps a blanket pardon for all staff involved, as well as for every single member who voted to stop the counting of the votes from Arizona and another state. But I did want to flag that also there was no pardon apparently sought by Jeffrey Clark, but he was rewarded with a position at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which is a Koch-funded group.
There you go.
And now works for another right-wing group that was emerged suddenly called the Center for Renewing America. So we're going to be looking into that.
There's always wingnut welfare available, isn't there? Heather, and actually, let me get both of you real quick thoughts on this. You know, with these, there was news on Wednesday that the DOJ apparently dropped subpoenas in at least 4 different states, looking to some of the folks who had signed up as fake Trump electors. Then there was the raid, apparently, on Jeffrey Clark's house on Wednesday. And of course, Merrick Garland has said in recent days that he and the January 6th investigators at DOJ are watching every hour of the House panel's hearings. Let me ask both of you, start with Heather. Do you have confidence that they are, in fact, at the DOJ, working their way up the food chain and will bring charges against not just the lackeys on the ground on January 6th, but the actual ringleaders of these plots, including the former president?
Well, I don't have any insight into the DOJ as Lisa does, but I can just say that it's obvious to me as just somebody observing this that they are following this alternate elector, fake elector situation now very seriously. And I even think the Jeffrey Clark thing may have had something to do with that, since he wrote that letter to Georgia, or he was trying to disseminate that letter to Georgia, in which they were sort of using the John Eastman theory about the, you know, with the alternate electors mm-hmm. and pressuring Mike Pence, which indicates, I think, what we're looking at is a conspiracy around that, right? It's not, and it's not just Eastman, and it's not just their lackeys, you know, doing work in the various states where mm-hmm. they had that. It appears that there looks like there's a conspiracy that they are uncovering here, and they have a grand jury working on that.
And
so
does,
to that extent, I think that much is happening.
And
sure.
it does look like they are working their way up, at least to me, because, you know, they've went to the organizers of the rallies on January 6th. Now they're going to the fake electors, and then we hear that they've, you know, raided Jeffrey Clark's house. It does seem like they're working their way up.
Well, the RNC was involved in that, too. We found that out mm-hmm. at the last hearing, that they actually, they conscripted the RNC to help them with the alternate electors. So this goes pretty deep.
I've got just a minute. Lisa Graves, do you have confidence that Merrick Garland is working his way up the food chain here?
I have no inside information, but certainly executing a search warrant is a sign that there's an ongoing criminal investigation, and I'm glad to hear that that's happening.
I think we're all glad to hear that. Des, you got any thoughts on this before
yes,
we get out?
Yes, I mean, I am team Marcy Wheeler on Empty Wheel. She is the one who has been following this more closely than I think anyone. She says, hey, have patience. This stuff takes time if you're going to do it right, and it must be done right.
You're right. All right. Well, guys, I think that we are being told that while they were going to have a sixth hearing, I think either this week or next, all of that is now being pushed back until after the 4th of July break, as I understand it. I don't know if it has to do with the new videotape that they've got, the new footage of the Trump family that they've got from this filmmaker.
Or Jenny Thomas.
Well, that's right, Jenny. Let's not ever forget about Jenny. Yes.
And Mo's coming up, too.
Who is?
Mo Brooks.
Mo Brooks.
Hey, I'm there. I'm ready to testify.
Oh, he did? He said he'll testify?
Yeah,
he did.
Under a bunch of conditions.
Well, now that he's got nothing to lose anymore because
yeah,
he lost
so
in Alabama. All right. Well, that should be fun. I will look forward to talking to you both again in the days ahead in that case. Thanks, guys. Of course, that's Heather Digby Parton. She is with Salon.com. She's a longtime contributor there. And you can also find her work at digbysblog.net and on the Twitters at Digby56. And Lisa Graves, former federal prosecutor, now...
Federal attorney.
Thank you. It's been a long day. Former federal attorney Lisa Graves, now finding respectable work at TrueNorthResearch.org. And you can also find her on the Twitters at TheLisaGraves. Thanks to both of you. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and
yep.
to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. That service is made possible by those of you kind enough to stop by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. To tell you the truth, you can drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am the Brad Blog. That is it. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.